Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanz on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Monday, August 21st, 2023. Journalists and civil society activists in South Sudan say they need support for creating awareness about South Sudan's upcoming elections.
We need money to produce materials such as dramas, whether they are in video form or in audio forms, to let people know what they need to do for elections.
And aid workers in South Sudan are calling on the government to protect humanitarian workers who face frequent attacks by armed groups.
One of the things that we'd want to call upon is action to be taken against the perpetrators of any form of gross human rights violations against aid workers.
And we'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The European Union and United Nations Development Programme have pledged €3 million for supporting suitable environment for elections in South Sudan. UNDP's deputy representative in South Sudan says his office and the European Union will support institutions tasked with the conduct of credible, inclusive and peaceful elections in South Sudan. For VOA News, Juliana Siapai has more from Juba.
The revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan, RACRIS, tasks its signatories to hold elections at the end of the transitional period in 2024. The European Union partnered with UNDP to implement a €3 million project to strengthen national institutions to play a key role in ensuring the scheduled elections are credible and inclusive. Patrick Oyet-Charles, the chairman of the Union of Journalists in South Sudan, says the media houses in the country require vital training on how to cover electoral campaigns. He says creating awareness about voting could prepare South Sudanese to participate effectively in the scheduled election in 2024.
We need money to produce materials such as dramas, whether they are in video form or in audio forms, to let people know what they need to do for elections, to let people know what they need to do to be even registered as voters, to be registered to contest if they want to do so. We also need money to produce public service announcements, jingles that are supposed to provide information to the public on the elections. If those are not done, then definitely it will be very difficult.
Timo Olkonen, European Union ambassador to South Sudan, says UNDP will support South Sudanese institutions to ensure the proposed elections are held on time.
The program that will be implemented by UNDP is expected to support and empower national actors, such as the transitional government, the public institutions on both national and subnational level, as well as the civil society, to work together towards fostering a more enabling environment for the elections.
UNDP's deputy resident representative in South Sudan stressed that the EU donation is aimed at strengthening and supporting South Sudanese institutions like the National Election Commission, NEC, and the Political Parties Council, PPC, to prepare the grounds for scheduled elections. Titus Osindina says key institutions in South Sudan will receive the much-needed support as they plan for the elections.
The project will also support the judiciary, media, and police to perform their electoral-related roles. There will be support for civil society, including women, youth, persons living with disabilities, and underrepresented groups to enable them to participate and engage in electoral processes.
The Secretary General of the National Election Commission says the institution needs support for developing electoral legal framework, dispute resolution, civic and voters' education. Ioannis Amunyikir added that the clock is ticking and his team will work with all the stakeholders and other partners to ensure elections are held on time.
Now we are left with 17 months to go for election. An election is a huge task, but with your presence and promise and support to us, we hope that in the coming months, we shall be having prepare all the process of election to go on in December 2024.
Lona Merkajay is the Secretary General of the civil society organization South Sudan Democratic Engagement Monitoring and Observation Program, or SODIMOP. Merkajay says the civil society is working to build partnership with international organizations to ensure credible elections are held in South Sudan.
The civil society and UNDP have to agree on priorities for support. And to us, institutional support is very important because we have seen how elections were run in 2010 and things must be done differently. Like, for example, we would expect investment in administrative and operative cost of national organizations similar to what UNDP would consider to do with the funds for international organizations.
UNDP, the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, UNESCO, and UN Women have pledged to offer the necessary support needed for the conduct of a credible elections in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shapai in Juba.
Some aid workers who experience attacks while on duty in South Sudan say they will continue to provide the much-needed help to vulnerable groups despite frequent attacks on aid workers across the country. The United Nations officials say South Sudan remains the most dangerous place for aid workers. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Ogwen Michael, who works for the non-profit Act for Humanity in Torit, says he and his colleagues fell into an ambush along the Torit-Kapwete Highway last year when they were returning from meeting stakeholders of project outside Torit. Michael says frequent attacks on aid workers will not deter him from saving lives through aid delivery.
They were not on the road. Nothing was put on the road, but they were just at the side of the road. So immediately we got the sound of the bullets from all sides. That is Kapweta Highway. Yeah, but we thank God the bullet did not get any of us, either me or my colleague. But on that, the car was just shot, but the driver managed to at least maneuver, and we cross over from the danger point.
A driver with the UN World Food Programme says he also escaped an attack by a known gunman along the Juba-Rombek Road. Yaya Sebit says his colleague was taken hostage by armed men during the ordeal.
Passed through the incident is because we just delivered the food for them, actually, so that they could pay for ourselves. And it is not only me alone, actually. One of my colleagues from Yei, also the same thing has been happening until they are kidnapped and go with him until the bush, like for 7 days, running up and down to look for him.
Sisi Kagaba, the executive director at the South Sudan NGO Forum, says aid workers in South Sudan face violent attacks, threats, looting of assets, and bureaucratic obstacles.
One of the things that we'd want to call upon is action to be taken against the perpetrators of any form of gross human rights violations against aid workers.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says it has recorded 44 incidents of attacks in the Greater Pibor Administrative Area, Upper Nile, Jongole, Unity, Central Equatoria, and Western Bahr Ghazal estates, where 22 aid workers were killed and 33 others wounded this year. Lokori Oscar Smith works for the non-profit called Gender Equity Women Leadership. He says he makes difficult decisions every day while delivering humanitarian aid to vulnerable groups in South Sudan.
What motivates us to continue working is when we see lives being saved and when we continue to rescue those who are still alive from the fields. Despite the challenges we face, insecurity on the roads, hardship while traveling, maybe ambushes and those kind of things. But no matter what, lives must be saved.
The humanitarian workers are calling on the government of South Sudan to protect aid workers. Albino Akol Attack, South Sudan's Minister for Humanitarian Affairs, says protecting aid workers is a priority of the government.
This situation must be reversed. The situation of us killing or attacking humanitarian workers must be reversed. We consider protecting humanitarian workers and civilians as our duty as the government of South Sudan.
While Humanitarian Day is marked every year on 19th of August as tribute to aid workers killed in line of duty, this year World Humanitarian Day campaign brought together the global humanitarian community to mark the 20th anniversary of the attack on the UN headquarters in Baghdad, Iraq in 2003. The attack killed 22 people, including the former United Nations Special Representative in Iraq, Sergio Ferreira de Mello, and wounded over 100, including human rights lawyer and political activist Amin Meki Medani. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A new report by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies says there were 6,225 reported deaths tied to Somalia's Al-Shabaab militia group in 2022, a 50% increase from the previous year, as the world marks the International Day of Remembrance and tribute to the victims of terror today, Monday. The United Nations says it is committed to supporting and amplifying the voices of victims and survivors. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
The Global Terrorism Index 2023 report indicates that terrorist attacks became more deadly last year, killing on average 1.7 people per attack in the same year compared to 1.3 deaths per attack in 2021. The Sahel region in sub-Saharan Africa is now the epicenter of terrorism, with the region accounting for more terrorism deaths in 2022 than both South Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa combined. And as the world marks International Day of Remembrance and tribute to the victims of terrorism, under the theme Legacy, Finding Hope and Building a Peaceful Future, some terror survivors who live to tell the story still live in fear. Lillian Munyiva is a Kenyan who survived the 1998 Nairobi bomb blast that targeted the U.S. Embassy.
On that day, I was at a cooperative building on the 12th floor working with the Teacher Service Commission, and I was expectant. My baby was born 3 weeks after the bomb blast. It was a normal day. We woke up, we went to the office normally, the way you just wake up and go to the office. We didn't think that anything bad would happen. We're busy with our normal routine. And actually, that is when the first blast happened.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the UN pays tribute to the extraordinary work of the victims and survivors who have resolved to use their experience to bring about change. Munyiva says most survivors are still traumatized, and some mothers gave birth to children with lifetime health conditions. She tells her story to fellow terror survivors for closure.
We have never healed at all. After the blast, after 2 weeks, from my community, we normally bury after 2 weeks. And it occurred to me that this would be my burial. And that really hit me so hard. All those people are still very hurting. The wounds are very, very fresh.
In the past few months, Kenya has experienced a surge in terror attacks that have left at least 30 security personnel dead in the coastal and northern eastern parts of the country due to Al-Shabaab ambushes. Kithure Kindiki, Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for the Interior and Administration of the National Government, told the Parliamentary Committee on National Security, Defense and Foreign Relations that the government will enhance patrols in affected regions.
We must continually commend our security officers. We have lost many of them in some of these engagements.
Vladimir Voronkov, the Undersecretary General of the United Nations Office of Counterterrorism, says the agency is today launching a legacy project that will feature victims and survivors of terror across the globe to tell their stories.
The United Nations Office of Counterterrorism is launching the Legacy Project, a new documentary gallery through social media to showcase how victims and survivors are creating a positive legacy.
According to the Global Terrorism Index 2023 report, the deadliest terrorist groups in the world in 2022 were the Islam State and its affiliates, followed by the Al-Shabaab, Bacholistan Liberation Army, and Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal Muslimin. Reporting for VOA, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, voters prepare to head to the polls in Zimbabwe. Find out how after this break.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. dial the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code plus one, then 202-258-3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Zimbabwe holds a national election on Wednesday. There are several names on the presidential ballot, but the top candidates represent the ruling ZANU-PF and Citizens Coalition for Change. Hosea Zenvashi is in Harare and reports on what sets the two contenders apart.
The ballot will list 11 presidential hopefuls in Zimbabwe's election. However, only 10 candidates actually are standing. That's because the Movement for Democratic Change withdrew its candidate, although the Electoral Commission said it was too late to do so. Despite the number on the ballot, the top contenders are the candidates' incumbent, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who heads the ZANU-PF, and Nelson Chamisa, leader of the Citizens Coalition for Change, or CCC. Political analyst Vivid Gwede says it's a contest of philosophies.
These are the two major ideas that are clashing this election. The clash between change and continuity in an environment where governance systems, structures and outcomes have not been beneficial to the majority of the people.
Mnangagwa, who is 80 years old, was a leader in the fight for independence. He was an ally of the late President Robert Mugabe, who led the country until he was ousted in a coup in 2017. Mnangagwa, then the vice president, became president. The 45-year-old Chamisa is making a second run for the presidency. The Protestant church leader formed the CCC last year after he was expelled from the long-standing opposition group, the Movement for Democratic Change. Rashid Mukundu, another political analyst, compares the top contenders' policies.
At a policy level, ZANU-PF has not pronounced itself through a manifesto, but we can make an assessment of its policies based on their current actions, which is a state-controlled and state-led development, which, however, is advancing a very kleptocratic socio-economic and political system in which only those who are close to the centers of power are benefiting, whereas Chamisa has pronounced on a more liberal economic policy, has pronounced on an end to corruption, has pronounced on both the public and private sector-led development initiative, an end to human rights abuses.
Contrary to Gwede and Mukundu, civic activist Abigail Mupambi says Chamisa's policies, in her words, are a high-sounding nothing.
What is setting them apart that Chamisa is banking on the populism approach, and which is exciting and exciting. In terms of policy, he has an inciting and hopeful policies, which of course are hollow in nature.
She says Mnangagwa's campaign is leveraging the development work he has carried out in the past 5 years with a promise to do more. She added that the voters have a choice between an unproven promise and a promise to improve on what has been done. Some political analysts have told VOA that Mnangagwa appeals to those wanting stability, but the country's crumbling economy has many, especially younger voters, seeking change. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Still on elections, Gabon is pleading with its close to 3,000 citizens in neighboring Cameroon to participate in the Saturday, August 26 elections by either voting or helping to maintain peace. Although major opposition parties in Gabon on Friday backed a single candidacy of former minister and university professor, 69-year-old Albert Ondisa Osa, voters and analysts in Cameroon say 64-year-old President Ali Bongo Ondimba will not let go of his family's 56-year grip on power in the oil-producing nation. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Gabon officials say 64-year-old President Ali Bongo Ondimba has instructed them to tell citizens living in Cameroon to be patriotic and not follow calls for an election boycott. Paul Patrick Bifort is Gabon's ambassador to Cameroon.
Nous approchons d'une échéance très...
Speaking in French, Bifort urges Gabon citizens in Cameroon to be united, peaceful, and respectful of laws in their host country while accomplishing their civic duties by effectively voting in this weekend's general elections. He says incumbent President Bongo wants all citizens of Gabon to vote freely and respect the results of the ballot. Bifort said Bongo, in a message to citizens, reiterated that all Gabonese at home, in Cameroon or elsewhere, should be peaceful before, during and after the polls. About 3,000 Gabonese live in Cameroon, and more than 300 have registered to vote in Saturday's elections. They are allowed to vote while still in Cameroon. Teacher Pierre-Marie Ondo is among the registered voters. Ondo says even though he is registered, he will not vote because Bongo is not healthy, following a stroke he suffered in 2019, and he still walks on crutches. He says the president is doing everything possible to stay in power until he dies. The Gabonese Elections Center reports that 18 opposition candidates are competing against Bongo. But on Friday, 5 opposition candidates said they agreed to support the candidacy of 69-year-old Albert Ondo Osa, former minister and university professor, in an alliance known as Alternance 2023. By joining forces, the opposition says they hope to defeat Bongo and end his family's 56 years at the top of the government. Kenny Rodolph is a visiting lecturer at Cameroon's Douala University. He says it will be very difficult to beat Bongo in the polls.
Il faut laisser la propagande sur la transparence démocratique.
Kenny says the talks about democratic transparency by officials in Gabon are just more propaganda. He says the Bongo family has confiscated the liberties and freedoms of citizens over the past 60 years, and President Bongo refuses to give up power. Bongo has always said his stay in power is democratic and that his victories in previous elections were fair. Bongo's last victory in 2016 triggered deadly clashes between police and protesters. Some demonstrators torched the parliament building in the capital, Libreville. Bongo has ruled the oil-producing nation for 2 7-year terms since succeeding his father, Omar Bongo, who died in 2009 after holding the presidency since 1967. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday, August 21st, 2023. When I leave you with Emmanuel Lasso and the song Intumia Junubin. We've been listening to Emmanuel Lasso and the song Intumia Junubin. Don't forget to visit VOA Africa for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Adrius Ridges, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been over 100 days since fighting broke out between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. And in that time, senseless violence has wrought unthinkable suffering, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield.
Millions of people have been displaced. Civilians have been shot dead in the street. Children have been orphaned, forcibly recruited, subjected to violence. Women have been brutally raped. Fighting has blocked humanitarian assistance, food, water, medicine, and other essentials from reaching people in dire need. There are credible reports that the rapid support forces and allied militias have carried out continued atrocities and other abuses in West Darfur.
The United States condemns these reported atrocities, which are an ominous reminder of the 2004 genocide in Darfur, declared Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
And we're gravely concerned about the risk of further conflict in North and Central Darfur, specifically by a reported buildup of rapid support forces and affiliated forces near El-Fasher, which poses a threat to non-Arab populations in the area. We're deeply concerned by unconfirmed reports of armed actors in Sudan preventing people from leaving the areas of Darfur in search of safety, including across the border into Chad.
We have a responsibility to not just extol human rights, but defend them, stressed Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. So we must all demand the parties comply with their obligations under international humanitarian law regarding the protection of civilians. The United States and its international partners are calling for the parties to immediately put down their weapons. In the meantime, the U.S., as the largest single donor of humanitarian assistance to the people of Sudan, is working to support the millions of internally displaced people and the nearly 1 million others who have fled into neighboring countries. Bureaucratic hurdles and other barriers have hindered relief efforts, warned Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
We call on Sudanese authorities to expedite visa approvals for humanitarian workers, enable the movement of humanitarian goods and personnel throughout Sudan, and facilitate the importation of humanitarian goods and equipment.
We must all urge the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces to end the bloodshed and end the suffering of the Sudanese people. There is no acceptable military solution to this conflict, warned Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, and peace cannot wait another day.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.